Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
When you looked at the barn, you'd see a barn full of all of these containers full of different kinds of cider. The magic is figuring out how to blend them together to make one that has all the different taste qualities.
A little acid, some sweetness, and a taste of tannins. Maria Kennedy studies cider making in England, and she speaks with us today. A recipe using apples with Chef Daniel Orr, but the star of the show is actually the pawpaws. Climate change is making growing food on a small scale difficult in some parts of the country. That's a story from Harvest Public Media. And roasting coffee beans is just like any other craft. The more care you take, the better the end result. This is Earth Eats. Let's get the news from Lou Ann Johnson.
According to a new State of Obesity report, there may be cause for a little cheer. For the first time in 10 years, data has shown small declines in the rate of obesity among children from low-income families. Only 40 states collect body mass index data for low-income children between the ages of 2 and 5. But out of those states, 18 showed that obesity rates shrank from 2008 to 2011. Overall, the obesity rate only increased in 6 states in 2013. The results are encouraging, but it's not exactly time to declare mission accomplished, health experts say. It's sort of like improving from an F to a D grade. Hopeful signs aside, the report still reflects some troubling numbers. Mississippi and West Virginia had obesity rates of 35.1%, and 20 more states showed rates above 30%. The economic divide is stark. In 2012, a quarter of people who earned at least $50,000 per year were obese. Among those who make less than $15,000, that number climbed to one-third. Over the last century, Americans have spent less and less of their household income on groceries and much more of that money for meals outside the home. Americans spend 6.1% of their household budget on food prepared in the home and 4.9% on eating out, according to recent figures from the USDA. The Indiana Farm Bureau and other farm-related groups are seeking the best way to brand Indiana-grown products. The Indiana Grown initiative was created a couple of years ago to promote local produce. Lawmakers are now considering how to label those products in the grocery store. The Indiana Farm Bureau's retail agriculture business specialist, Bob White, says they want to know whether the Indiana Grown brand is really working. Right now, 90% of the food sold in Indiana is imported from other states or countries. He says even a modest reduction in that figure would help Hoosier farmers immensely. Agriculture is a $28 billion industry in Indiana. The farm bill may have reduced food assistance, but it turns out that the cuts are not as drastic as originally designed. Lawmakers sought to save $8.6 billion over 10 years by cutting the food stamp program. One loophole existed. With heat assistance comes an increase in food assistance. States were able to provide as little as $1 in heating assistance to low-income residents as a way of continuing their food benefits. The practice is called heat and eat, and 16 states allow it. 12 of those states are fighting the food stamp cuts. Republicans who fought for the cuts initially were outraged, even calling the practice fraud. In response, they raised the minimum for heat allowance from $1 to more than $20, hoping to price states out of the loophole. Of the 12 states fighting to keep food stamps, 4 have announced reductions: Michigan, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and New Hampshire. Michigan has said it cannot withstand a $20-plus increase as it would affect others in need of heat assistance. A family of 4 in Michigan could see, on average, $76 less per month in food assistance. Read more about these stories and share them with your Twitter followers. Links are collected at eartheats.org.
That's right. And speaking of Twitter, we've been tweeting about edible food packages and why seaweed is so good for you. We'd love to have you as part of the conversation. Connect with us at Earth Eats. Lou Ann Johnson, the voice of our food news.
That's me. See you in a week.
Local food is no longer just a novelty. It's a billion-dollar business. But despite all the demand, making local food work in some places is decidedly more difficult than in others. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports.
Oh, right there, yeah. Josh Kilbane walks along a narrow dirt road outside of Steamboat Springs, Colorado. His herd of Scottish Highland cattle, the kind with long, shaggy bangs and curved horns, munch on tall green grasses behind an electric fence.
She's a nice cow. She is so smart. It's just unbelievable. Yeah, she'll be...
You'll hear lots of those moos here at Yampa Valley Farms, and oinks, too. Kilbane also raises hogs. The one thing you won't hear much of anymore is the clucks of chickens.
Well, what spawned it was the idea of creating really, really healthy, good chicken.
Kilbane bought thousands of chickens and processing equipment last year. He explored whether local restaurants would buy local chicken for a premium price.
We could sell these birds, and it sounds ridiculous, but for $15 to $18 a bird.
The demand was there, but after crunching the numbers, the project was scrapped.
It would cost somewhere between $250 and $350, $100,000, to build a plant to process birds to the specifications of the federal government. And that pushes us out as a small farm right off the bat.
And there's really no other place in northwest Colorado where a small local farmer could drop off chickens for processing. There are places to take cattle, but no chickens. It's a familiar story all over the Midwest. There are huge chicken processing plants, but you can't get in there if you're not contracted with a company. So chalk that up as problem number one, a lack of infrastructure. Problem number two, the growing season.
Our challenge in Colorado, and particularly in the Steamboat area, is that our growing season is about 59 days. From frost to frost. And so it is a real challenge for people growing their own food.
Karen Massey is the Colorado State University Extension agent for Rauch County. That number, 59 days, is something you hear over and over in Steamboat Springs. It's even on the cover of a gardening guide the Extension office hands out. With cold winters and steamy summers, farmers growing food in the Midwest know unpredictable weather is a headache. Massey says that's why many farmers markets can feel more like flea markets.
There have been very creative businesses started with season extenders, but it's a long haul. We sometimes get 400 inches of snow.
But those season extenders, like greenhouses and hoop houses, can be expensive and tough to maintain. And if they get too big, they can bring up another impediment to local food production: government regulation. Steamboat Springs, like many cities and towns with local foodies, functions under a master plan that discourages sprawl into the open space that surrounds the town. Alan Goldich is with Rauch County, Colorado's planning department.
We want to keep those commercial uses in the growth centers or near the growth centers. And when you start to expand those commercial uses outside of those growth centers, then you start to lose that western rural character, the open agricultural feel.
Goldich says his office has started passing along worksheets to aspiring local food growers as a bit of a reality check about the uphill battle they can face. There are lots of permits to file and specifications to meet in order to get a business off the ground. Even with all the roadblocks, Rauch County Planning Director Chad Phillips says it's not stopping all prospective farmers.
What we're seeing is some of the newer people either to the, you know, to the county or just with a different perspective that they want to make this work. And they're not doing it because it's easy money. They're doing it because their hearts are into it.
That passion can be clearly seen by the lively online bartering that goes on when a person's garden is overly productive. And more than a handful of people in town have taken advantage of a state law that allows cooks to sell foods prepared in the home. And back at Yampa Valley Farms, Josh Kilbane says yes, the climate in Steamboat can be harsh. But that's no reason to throw your hands in the air and give up. When 10 feet of snow drops on the ranch, his shaggy Scottish cattle and woolly dreadlocked hogs barely realize it.
I'm not going to stop it from being 40 below and 60-mile-an-hour windstorms, but that I can match that animal to that storm.
Kilbane says it's that kind of adaptation farmers in the Midwest have been doing forever to survive, and it'll be a matter of adapting even further to meet the demand of a new market that increasingly wants food to be locally produced. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
They talk about food and farming at Harvest Public Media. Lots of great stories from their reporters at harvestpublicmedia.org. Maria Kennedy first fell in love with cider 10 years ago when she went to England to volunteer at an orchard in Devon. She says the experience was nothing short of magical.
And when I was done working in the garden, I could go tap the barrel and sit and drink a cider.
Oh my gosh, that does sound magical.
It was very magical. And just that whole process of change from like the trees in the orchard to this glass full of beautiful liquid that is just kind of otherworldly.
She went back to that part of the world in 2012 to conduct research. She's a folklorist. While at these orchards, she harvested fruit, pressed it into juice, poured the juice into barrels, the whole process from apple to cider. She came into the Earth Eats studios recently to talk about her time there, just as apple season is really getting started.
The guy who owned the place who I was volunteering with was replanting it with heirloom varieties with really cool names like Slack McGirdle and Chisel Jersey, Harry Masters Jersey, a lot of local varieties too. There are lots and lots of varieties of apple in England that are used just for making hard cider.
That's the orchard in Devon. She says there were 90 varieties of apples grown at that place, all of which ripened at different times throughout the year.
In a well-planned orchard, you'll have apple varieties, different apple varieties that will ripen all the way from the middle of summer to December or January, because it gives the farmer the opportunity to harvest all those different fields of fruit at different times. So he's got something to do, or she. So it's kind of like a way of mapping out your work for the whole season.
And then they make the cider from the different varieties mm-hmm. as the year goes on.
Yeah, some cider varieties that you make, the early fall apples or late summer apples, they aren't going to keep as long. So you want to drink that a little bit more fresh. That might be ready to drink by Christmas. Other cider varieties, especially the late ones, the ones you might harvest in December, you might want to leave those for a whole year. Because if you think about it, the apple's been on the tree for several months longer. It's got a thicker skin. It's got more tannin. So by December, there's just a lot more tannin in there. And it takes time, like a good wine with a lot of tannin in it, to develop the flavors.
Each apple variety has its own unique characteristics. Kennedy learned how to pick out the different apples based on the taste of a cider. She says some locals are uncannily skilled at that.
I was really surprised when I went over there and I tasted cider for the first time. It was so different from cider in the United States. And I should say that in the last year or two, there's been this explosion of hard cider in the United States. And there's a lot of stuff going on. So the landscape is changing every day. But over in England, it's really traditional.
Traditional in the way they make the cider, she explains.
So what we do is we smush the apples up in a grinder that's almost like a mulching machine.
Then we put seeds and all, stems.
Seeds, stems. And then we take the pulp and put it into the press. And on the press, there would be a pressing cloth. Pile the apple pulp into the cloth, fold the cloth up, and then put another cloth on top. And we just stack them up. So there's probably like 9 folded cloths full of apple pulp. And then we get the press going and start smushing them together so that all the juice starts to run out. And we collect the juice in a bucket and just keep running back and forth with the buckets and putting them into either these big 1,000-liter plastic containers or the old wooden barrels. And we would get some barrels from a few barrels from some whiskey distilleries up in Scotland just to add a little extra flavor.
Am I understanding it correctly that the same people who grow the apples press them and also ferment it into cider? Is it all done at the same place?
Yeah. So that's what makes it really traditional in a way, is that it's just one farmer, Mike Johnson, who is my boss. He grew apples for Bulmers, which was one of the biggest cider producers in the world. They're now owned by Heineken. He grew apples for them on contract. And one year, Bulmers didn't take the apples. And he was like, well, what am I going to do with all these apples? And his dad had always made cider at home for the family and for some neighbors and friends. So he just decided to start making his own cider and make a business out of it.
Kennedy remembers the barn. That's where they kept all the containers of the apple juice. The process of making a tasty cider sort of sounds like witches stewing their brew.
And the magic is figuring out how to blend them together to make one that's really has all the different taste qualities. A little bit of acid, a little bit of tannin, sweetness too.
Folklorist Maria Kennedy. More about her experience with cider makers in England at ciderwithmaria.wordpress.com. Coming up.
What I do sometimes is puree it and then cook it with some eggs and make a almost like a creme brulee out of it.
It's not a banana, although it sort of looks like one. It's not a mango, although it sort of tastes like one. It's a pawpaw. Chef Daniel Orr makes a couple dishes. Ahead, we'll also observe a small-scale coffee roaster in action. This is Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Fall is a great time for foraging for wild fruits, pawpaws, for instance. Chef Daniel Orr is throwing together 2 dishes today featuring this very interesting fruit. First, dessert.
All right. Well, we're in autumn now, and what we have here today are pawpaws. They also call them the Indiana banana, and it is the most northern growing tropical type of fruit in America. And it kind of looks like a kidney, a little bit.
It's a green kidney.
And when you cut them in half, they've got, you know, the seeds down the middle. It almost looks like a fava bean a little bit, the way the seeds are. And it has this really interesting flavor, kind of a mango, banana, papaya, all combined.
Tell me where you got these.
These are grown by a local fellow that brought them into the restaurant yesterday. But you can find them growing wild. The wild ones are generally a lot smaller. And as you can see, these are really nice, big, and fleshy. They're beautiful. They grow in semi-shade. They've got large, almost tropical-looking leaves on them. The fruit's ready usually in September, October, into early November. But basically, you're going to scoop out the flesh of the pawpaw, just like you would kind of taking the kiwi out of the kiwi skin. You could either do it with a knife and peel it, or I like to just cut them in half and take them out, and then you're going to pass it through a food mill to get out those seeds, and then you have a pawpaw puree, and that you can freeze, or you can use it right away. We're going to take a half cup of raisins. I've got a cup of water, a half cup of raisins, and a half cup of chopped dates. And I'm going to bring that to a boil and let those moisten up and kind of soak up that water. Plump up a little bit. Okay, and to this we're going to add the rest of the ingredients. A half cup of butter.
Not messing around.
Well, you'll see, this makes a lot of cookies. To that we're going to add a cup of oatmeal. So see, that's healthy. Okay, and then we've got 1/4 teaspoon of salt, 1/4 teaspoon of baking soda, and 3/4 teaspoon of baking powder. So they're going to get a little fluffy. Okay, and then we've got 1/4 teaspoon of Chinese 5-spice powder and 1 cup of flour. And we're going to add 3/4 cups of pawpaw puree. Okay, and you can kind of see this is all coming together. The oatmeal is starting to absorb some of that liquid. Okay, and then we're going to add 2 eggs and 1/2 cup of walnuts. And I like to toast my walnuts a little bit before I use them in any kind of recipe because it extracts some of the moisture and intensifies the flavor. Okay, then we're going to spoon this dough onto a cookie sheet and bake them at 350 for about 10 minutes.
Now, these cookies didn't have an overwhelmingly pawpaw flavor to them. They were nice and mild, very delicate. Our next pawpaw recipe with Daniel Orr could be eaten for breakfast, so stay with us to hear that one. Let me direct you to our website, which is the hotspot for recipes. That's eartheats.org. Here's your caffeine fix with Partridge and Quigley Roasting Company. Roasting is the key for creating the desirable flavor and aroma for your cup of joe. As with most crafts, the more time and care you take with roasting, the better the product. Micro roasteries process small batches of coffee beans to exact specifications. The beans are air-dried, not doused with water like they do in commercial operations. This all results in a much fresher product than the alternative. Let's take a listen.
I just made a fresh pot of coffee, but I don't use sugar or cream, so it's black.
S.K. Quigley is the man behind Partridge and Quigley Coffee Roasting Company in Bloomington, Indiana. Partridge isn't his business partner. It's just a name he added to his to give his roastery some gravitas. A veteran of the restaurant business, he took up coffee roasting in Denver and quickly realized he had both a passion and a taste for it. Micro-roasted coffee wasn't anything like the stuff he grew up with.
The coffee that I was exposed to as a younger person came out of can. You know, Maxwell House, Folgers. What was the one out of New York? A chock full of nuts. And it was a coffee that, my God, if you didn't add cream and sugar to it, it just wasn't very tolerable.
He's converted a double garage into his roasting facility, where he prepares beans every day of the week except Friday. The one old-school machine he uses is at the far end, surrounded by bags and bags of raw coffee beans.
This is a Sumatran coffee.
Oh, it's darker.
Darker green. Then you can look at a Guatemalan.
Yeah, much lighter.
Yeah, it's kind of a gray-green. And then you can see a Colombian bean, which is lighter yet.
He's using some of each of these beans in the breakfast blend he's roasting this morning. This coffee will be used at restaurants around Bloomington and Indianapolis. Quigley is at the key point in the roasting process right now, where he releases the freshly roasted beans from the roasting chamber into the cooling tray. Allowing the beans to heat even 2 degrees too much would mean disaster.
I'm right on the very end of the roast, and I'm kind of monitoring it. We're going to drop this at 400 degrees.
398, 397, 99, 400.
And if you look in the inside of this roaster, looks like a washing machine. It's got those fins in it. And those fins keep the bean from hitting the side of the roaster where they would scorch. You're wanting to float these beans in the hot air.
Can you talk to me about this machine? Because it looks like a bit of an old-fashioned machine.
It is. It's a Probat. It's German-made. I roasted on one of these machines 40 years ago in Denver. That's where I learned to roast. But I think it probably dates back even further than that. When you pull anything out in this mass, you can hear it still crackling. I'm trying to pull the temperature down as quickly as possible so the roast remains at the point that I want it to remain. And it, I'm pushed air from the roasting chamber onto this cooling tray. I'll hold this, reach in, and you can feel the warmth still there. Now be careful about the swing arm.
Yeah, it's still warm to touch.
This temperature will drop down from the point that I pulled the coffee almost 200 plus degrees.
Gosh, I was thinking the roastery would smell like coffee, but it doesn't really smell like coffee yet. I'm getting a little bit of the aroma, yeah. But not much.
No. If I took this out and served it to you straight from the cooling tray, just wouldn't have much to it. once this is roasted, for one day, we do not use it. It has to outgas. The second and third day are better for a roasted coffee. And it takes that period of time, that 24 hours, to pull itself together. It's kind of like when you make a soup. It's always better the second day.
Ah, so I guess we'll have to be patient. Pictures of SK quickly roasting coffee beans are at eartheats.org. Back to cooking with Chef Daniel Ord.
Where, oh, where is dear little Susie? Where, oh, where is dear little Susie? Where, oh, where is dear little Susie? Way down yonder in the pawpaw patch. Picking up pawpaws, put them in your pocket.
There's an old song my grandma and grandpa used to sing to me about way down yonder in the pawpaw patch. They used to love eating these. When back in that time, they didn't really have all the fresh fruits and all the candies and things that we have now, and they lived out in the country. And so when these ripened up, they would eat these until they got sick. They were so excited. They would find a tree on the way home from school when they walked home, and they would eat the pawpaws until they turned green. You can scoop the whole thing out and then cook it in a syrup and then puree it and get the seeds out, or you can just kind of pull the seeds out like I've done and just kind of mash it. What I do sometimes is puree it and then cook it with some eggs and make almost like a creme brulee out of it. One thing that really goes nice with pawpaw is lime juice, and it really brings out a completely different flavor in the pawpaw. All right, and then what we're going to do today is just make a little pawpaw and apple salad. And very simple, we've got some nice apples from Apple Works, which is up in Trafalgar, Indiana. This, I believe, is a Jonathan. We're going to just cut around the core. Okay, and now we're just going to toss it in the pawpaw mixture just to give it a nice little coat. And this is great just like this, or you could, you know, serve some ice cream or sorbet with it. Got a little bit of Thai basil I'm going to garnish it with. And there you go. You've got a very nice Southern Indiana, simple, nutritious dessert, or a great way to start the day. You could have this for breakfast as well.
We had fun with this one. Chef Daniel Orr, that's a creative guy right there, and his recipes are very, very easy. Find lots of tasty dishes using foods of the season on our website, which is eartheats.org. Our Earth Eats crew includes Aya Bonbinder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and those amazing folks at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Wishing you a gorgeous fall day. Hopefully it's filled with some local homemade food. I'm Annie Corrigan for Earth Eats.